Hi, I'm Rip Stalvey, and I want to welcome you to another episode of the Poultry Keepers Podcast. Joining me in the studio are Madeline Royal and John Gunnerman, the rest of our podcast team, and we are really looking forward to visiting with you and talking poultry from feathers to function. Okay, we've talked about the backs. Now let's move a little further down the bird and talk about the tails. You know, you have to think about the size, the shape, angle of the tail carriage, and the spread of the tail. And those are all defined in the standard of perfection. So, Mandy, what's your thoughts on selecting for tail?
So when I look at the breed standard, it's going to mention the angle of the tail. And the tricky part of that is the bird is going to change that angle as it moves around based on how it's standing. So you can't make a snap decision on tails. And they also can change over time, too. So what they look like at 6 months old might be different than what they look like at a year and a half old. So I'm learning to be patient on tails to see what they're really going to turn into. And I'm only looking for what's an outright flaw to a tail, like if it's a rye tail, split tail, something like that. You can see that earlier, but it might also show up later. So tails are something I'm just trying to be patient and looking at.
Yeah, I agree with you. It takes a little bit of time for those things to really develop and settle in.
It's really helpful to watch them just in their natural habitat to get an idea of where their tail is in general, because it'll change. Based on what's going on in the environment. If there's predators around, the tail's going to do one thing. If there's anything above them, they're naturally, the tail set's going to drop. You know, that's why I don't have a nice little viewing pen with a top on it like Mandy does. When I set one up with a camera so I could get a downward shot. As soon as I did, I saw my Chanticleer's tail drop maybe 10
degrees. It makes a big difference.
Oh. In the show, I mean, I'm sure that's what they refer to as coop conditioning, to get your bird to show properly because it gets accustomed to being in a cage.
You take a bird that's been running out and you put it in a show coop, it's going to almost instantly change the way they look. I know Sue Dobson's red champion up there at the Ohio National. If you looked at that bird in the coop, you saw that his head was kind of shrunken down to his shoulders. His tail was going downhill instead of being level like it should be. And that was because he was in a coop, and over the top of the coop was a piece of plywood because they had set bantam coops on top of the large fowl coops. And anytime you do that, it's going to make them hunker down.
It's also important to look at them in all their different areas. Don't only base your opinion off of when they're in a viewing cage. Don't only base your opinion when they're out in the field. You want to see them in every scenario to get an idea of what's really going on. And then you want to find out what angle and shape and length and all of that you're supposed to have for your particular breed, because every single one of them wants a slightly different variation.
You bring up a good point there. In measuring tail angles, we'll use breasts for an example. Their back should slope from basically their shoulders back to the tail, have a downward slope to it. Do you measure the angle of the tail from the horizontal plane, or do you take into account the amount of slope in the back?
At this point, it's kind of both, depending on the overall balance I'm seeing from the bird. With where they're at in development, I've got some other stuff to pay attention to first before refining tails. So long as they're not squirrely or too thin or otherwise wonky, it's something I'm looking for later in the actual particular angles. I've got other stuff to fix.
The standard actually prescribes that it be measured from a horizontal plane as if the back were level to get
that
the proper tail. That puts everybody
in
the
same. File that tidbit back for later.
And if your particular breed has a flat back, or it's prescribed to have a flat back, that makes it a little easier.
Reds are really easy to evaluate tails because they have that long, level, horizontal back.
Yeah, that would make it easier.
You know, you were talking about looking at your birds when they're doing different things. sometimes I've just been known to go out there with a video camera and just turn the birds out that I want to evaluate. And just sit there and video them as they move around, as they scratch. I want them to feel comfortable, to feel relaxed. You can do more to evaluate birds that way than any other way that I've found.
Well, and you can go back and reference it later too. And you can check out some other details, like what their legs are doing, what their wings are doing, how alert they are, watching their behaviors. There's a lot to be seen when you're just observing. And then if you video it, now you've got references to go back to if you need to.
And you were looking at a video of some Chanticleer, and we'll talk about this in a minute, and you spotted something going on with the legs that I didn't see. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you do get flock blind. So having somebody else take a look at something, you know, you spotted it right away.
We talked about tails and evaluating those.
Oh, I did have one more tail comment. One of the things I'm looking for is for the back end of the tails to be open rather than pinched. And then what that looks like is when you're looking from the backside of the bird with like a head-on shot of the rear, if those tail feathers touch each other and it's real tight, that can indicate a narrowness that's on the backside that's not just the tail. Like once you put your hands on them, you can confirm it. But I'm looking for almost like a tented shape there where there's an openness between either side of those tail feathers.
The old timers used to call that a teepee shape because if you look at the bird from the rear end, it's got that elongated V shape. You can rest assured that that's tied in to the width of the back.
That's mirroring the structure that's ahead of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the leg. How far are the legs apart? The wider the legs are apart, the greater the width of the tail will be from side to side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the spread of the tail is directly tied, at least to the latter half of the body capacity.
You brought up something good, and that's the next thing I think we need to talk about is body capacity. What it is, why it's important, and how to look for it. John, what are your thoughts?
You need the basic room for the organs to fit and do their stuff naturally. So too tight of a body, too narrow. I equate everything to the kitchen. So I see some things that are, you know, torpedo shaped, like torpedo rolls. They're kind of narrow at the front and narrow at the back and, you know, broadest at the shoulders, but it's too pinched, and that's going to cause all the internal organs to be stressed. I like to go for this cinder block shape where I've got, you know, a lot of room for the hen to have her organs and do her reproductive thing. And, you know, roosters can be roosters. They need to be able to defend their flock and be able to carry themselves and ward off predators or at least warn of them.
And, you know, I had somebody ask me one time, well, why do I need to be worried about body capacity? I said, well, body capacity dictates so much else that goes on in a bird, rate of growth.
It's the frame. It's what everything is built on. You can't put 2 pounds of poop in a 1 pound bag, as my grandfather
said. Exactly. Well, and remember that even during egg laying, once it's into the, what do they call that? The calcification process, that egg's in there spinning and turning and moving down through the laying track. And if it's tight, then it's going to not function probably as well as it should. And it's going to want a priority of space that can affect the other organs, especially if you get them too fat, that further causes additional inside constriction. And you might see some problems coming from poor structure, poor capacity.
You could have torpedo-shaped eggs, or you could have golf ball-shaped eggs, and that's going to be a reflection on the body capacity.
Well, and with where the laying equipment is, it's right up underneath the spine, and you can even have poorly shaped eggs if it's pushed up into that back. So when the egg gets laid, it'll look pretty normal until you turn it to one side that'll have like a flat spot on it.
Another thing is that body capacity is linked to, if you have birds that your females suffer from getting egg bound, where they can't actually lay the egg because the egg is so big and they have that physical blockage there between the pubic bones, that can cause you some real problems. It causes you to lose some of those birds.
You'll absolutely lose them, because if they prolapse once, they're going to do it again.
Well, then you need to lose them.
Yeah, they shouldn't be part of the breeding equation. That's for sure.
I mean, nature selects pretty well for us naturally. We're the maybe the ones messing it up, because we're always, I think, trying to go, oh, this is a really nice bird. Let's give her a chance, when you should have maybe put her in the stew pot a long time ago.
Yeah, there's not any one trait that is worth sacrificing the important things for. It doesn't matter what their head is like, what their comb is like, their color. That all is secondary, at least to me it is, when you're looking at those more important utility traits that help with their health and function.
So, Rip, there's a couple of terms that I'd like to clear up from the standard that talk about heart girth. Two or three more, I'm sure we're going to work our way around to.
Well, to me, heart girth, and I like to measure that when I'm evaluating birds, I'll put my thumb on the very top of the back up near the neck. And then I'll put my middle finger underneath the bird on the bird's breast. That'll give me an evaluation of how deep that chest cavity is. And then
So top to bottom.
Top to bottom and side to side.
Is that in front of the wing?
Yes, I do it in front of the wing. And the greater the heart girth, the more efficient that bird becomes at processing feed, just being able to live, in other words. It's directly linked to the bird's overall quality.
The vital organs, they call it the heart girth, because that's pretty much where the heart muscle is.
Right. It's just like if you were measuring it on a horse or a cow or something like that. Heart girth is important there, just like it is important in a chicken.
I like how thoroughbreds are so deep in the chest because they're working hard and...
Yeah, the heart muscle needs room to work.
Heart muscle, lung capacity, it's all tied into that. Hi there, poultry keepers. This is Rip, one of the voices behind the Poultry Keepers podcast. We're on a mission here to create a larger, more vibrant community of poultry enthusiasts, and we need your help. If you enjoy our poultry conversations and insights, here's a simple way to support it. Just spread the word and share the Poultry Keepers podcast with your fellow poultry lovers. By recommending us, you're not only helping our show grow, but you're also connecting more people with the joy of poultry keeping. So hit that share button, post it on your socials, or tell your chicken-loving friends about it. Let's grow a larger community together. Thanks for being part of the Poultry Keepers family. Now, back to our show.
Well, we covered the depth of the body and how important that is. If we're just working our way down the bird, then we get to think about the straightness and the width between the legs, because that's what the whole body is standing on.
Yes. And, you know, like I mentioned before, if you've got a good wide bird, you're going to have a well-formed tail with a nice spread side to side and top to bottom. Although I realize that's kind of a cosmetic thing, but that spread in the bird between the leg is related to heart girth. It is related to body capacity. And you want legs that are straight top to bottom, because if they're turned in or cow hocked, as most folks would say, that's indicating a bird that's wider at the top than it is kind of down at the bottom. Those are the ones that have leg problems, have trouble walking.
And they can also be bow-legged.
Yeah.
Too.
They can.
And that's the opposite problem. And those are structural defects, and those should not be bred forward.
Exactly. And it's easy to evaluate if you're watching your birds, if they turn and walk towards you, directly towards you, or directly away from you, it becomes readily apparent if those legs are straight or if there's a problem with them.
Yeah, the more you look for it, the more you see it.
Yeah.
And I've also noticed that the legs and how they're set and where they're positioned on the body, and if they're coming down bowed in, there's almost always a very steep and sharp V shape to the keel that's very narrow, more often than not. And that's a problem I've noticed on most birds of most varieties I've tried. It's almost like the underside of the bird is getting completely neglected.
Well, so many people really pay attention to the top line of the bird, or let's say the top half of the bird, because it's easy to see visually. And they forget all about the equally important, it's the bottom half of the bird when viewed from the side.
Because well, for purpose and for table, the underside's even more important if you're worried about what it's going to look like in a shrink bag.
That's the meat. Yeah. That's the breast.
Yeah, that's the part that's turned up for display. If they're narrow or pointy or sharp or otherwise not looking very meaty, that's the first thing you're going to see as soon as they're in a shrink bag.
Absolutely. And amount of body fleshing is something we need to touch on too. Because if you don't have good body fleshing, you're going to have a really small carcass to eat, because that's directly tied to the amount of breast meat, the amount of thigh and leg meat.
Also your feed conversion ratio. If you're feeding and keeping and housing a bird for that long and it's only producing X amount of meat, where the bird right next to it is producing, you know, 125% in the same time, space, and feed, you know, who's more efficient?
Well, and if you've already accounted for your environment, your husbandry methods, and you've already ruled out feed as being the either helping or hindering what's going on, if you know you're on the right track with everything, but that fleshing still is not there, then that's when you start looking at the genetic influence and if they're even going to be able to produce birds that have a better condition. And I've experimented a little bit by taking a really meaty bird and breeding it to one that wasn't that great to see how that would kind of spread forward in the hatch results. And when there is a genetic tie, you might only see 25 to 50% of them as being as meaty as the one parent, and then the others are as not meaty as the other parent, which was interesting confirmation to not be tolerant on poorly fleshed birds for the sake of other traits. I know it's not worth it.
To me, in a way, this goes back to what we were talking about when we first started, and that's the importance of the balance of the bird.
Yeah.
If you've got birds that are shallow breasted and kind of pinched in, tucked up in the rear, it looks out of balance.
Mm-hmm. So for the first couple of years, maybe the birds that actually would look best in the shrink bag are the ones you want to breed from instead.
That's what I did initially.
Yeah, you put your lesser quality birds. When we're doing restoration forestry, we call it low grading your forest, where you're doing single tree selection, worst first. You're taking the worst out first and only leaving your best trees to grow and mature. So you're always building the best possible forest. I see a direct correlation here.
Oh,
single tree selection, worst first out.
That's
and by the time you're done, you just have great birds. And you're like, oh, you know what? You look the most like this bird and you both meet the standard. So you can have some conjugal visits and I'm going to collect your eggs and we'll see what you do.
Okay. We were on legs. Let's move down to the toes. They should be
toes.
Nice.
Toes can be frustrating.
Yeah.
Especially as soon as you get your incubation right. At least for me, toes cleared up a lot of issues. I was culling for crooked toes unnecessarily because there is a direct correlation to incubation temperature accuracy, especially in the early development stages.
Right.
And if it's not that, it's riboflavin. Nutritional things can affect it. The incubation can affect it. You have a lot of legwork to rule out things before you can pin it to genetics.
Well, and you know, you were talking about nutrition. And it's important to remember that it's not just the nutrition we feed the chick. It's the nutrition that we feed the breeders. Because if they don't have good nutrition bases, they can't put all the nutrients those developing embryos will need up until they hatch.
Right.
I mean, so a human finds out she's pregnant, bam, prenatal vitamins, folic acid especially.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the essential amino acids become even more essential when you're building an offspring. I don't care what species it is. And that's going to help epigenetically set the chick up for success. Because as it's being developed, it has access to all these things. So it's going to breed forward better and stronger. It's going to come out of the egg with a higher hatch weight initially, which is going to translate to its entire life.
I heard somewhere that if you see nutritional issues prior to 10 or 12 weeks, it very likely came from the adults being deficient in what they were able to put into that egg for that chick.
It's like if you do get crooked toes or a wry neck or something, look at the onset. Is it before, after, you know, 2 days, 3 days? Is it before or after, you know, a week and a half to 2 weeks? It'll tell you whether it was, I don't want to say prenatal, pre-shell or catch. What is the proper term for that? I feel so non-scientific.
I don't know. I'm sure there is one.
There is.
Probably is.
Pre-hatch.
You know, talking about straightness of toes, I got a question for you guys. If the rear toe twists around forward, what's that called?
Duck foot.
There you go.
I got one right.
Hey, winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Does that mean it's initially coming off the shank straight back and curves back around, or it's coming off?
The whole placement is off.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, because I've seen them come straight back and then curve back around.
I think that's different. I think that's
just not taking care of your chicken's nails, I think.
Duck foot is when that toe's coming off almost at a right angle to where it should.
So it should come straight back. If you look at your chicken footprint in the snow or in the mud or whatever is soft ground around you, should come straight back in their gait naturally.
Wow, that'd be a good way to test them out. Scatter some flour on a smooth surface, set your chicken to walk on it, and it'll tell you where that toe is.
Or just wait till it snows. The way it's been going, pretty much anywhere in the country is likely to get snow. Even maybe you, Rip. I saw it snow in Naples, Florida in 1980 mumble something on Christmas Day, I remember, because iguanas were falling out of trees.
It snowed here. Interestingly, on January the 19th, 1977, we got 3 inches of snow here where I live.
So it can happen.
It melted the same day.
Yeah.
Most of it did, but some of it was around for two, 3 days.
All right. Well, we're getting distracted. Let's talk about straight keels.
Straight keels. You've been selecting hard for this, Mandy.
So hard. I'm so sick and tired of seeing that flaw. I've seen it in every breed I ever put my hands on, mostly because of how I was sourcing my birds, because I like to make things more work than they need to be. But the keels, oh man, there's a lot of different shapes they can be. And you want them straight and smooth. And not bowed inward, not bowed outward, just a nice, straight, even, probably long, too. There's not too many that should have a short keel. But measuring them and getting your hands on them, that's the only way you're going to know what you're looking at. Rip, how do you measure your keels?
When I first pick up a bird, I put the front point of the keel bone up against the heel of my hand. And then I lay the keel bone along through the palm of my hand, along my index finger. That allows me to feel, is it straight or not, and how long it is.
That's also different than how I do it. We should hang out and handle birds.
The other end, I like to see it, you know, inside the carcass after it's been cooked. I look at the cartilage and the bones and see. I have this image. Remember the old Battlestar Galactica series, the Colonial Viper spaceship?
Oh, yeah.
To me, that looks just like the cartilage and keel should look
You're right.
In a chicken.
I never thought of it that way, but you're right. So I'm not the only one pulling the bones out and looking real close.
I mean, if it's sitting on the platter and you're taking it apart when you're eating it, I mean, as I'm enjoying the meat, I'm definitely analyzing the carcass of the bird that I'm consuming. And
this brings us to the close of another Poultry Keepers podcast. We're happy you chose to join us today. Until next time, we'd appreciate it if you would drop us a note letting us know your thoughts about our podcast. And please share our podcast with all your friends that keep poultry too. We hope you'll join us again when we'll be talking poultry from feather to function.